today I'm here talking with Renata. Renata is works in antitrust at Wilson Sonsini. Antitrust is a pretty important area of law that can affect companies as they become very powerful within the market. And Wilson Sonsini is one of the top technology law firms in the United States. And so we've got someone of a pretty high caliber in terms of the legal aspect on this to talk with. So Renata, thanks for joining us.
Happy to be here.
Maybe you can tell us a little bit about yourself, who you are, and where you've come from.
Sure. So I'm a native Californian. I grew up in Berkeley, which is obviously a big university town. I grew up in Berkeley. People always say, I didn't know people grew up in Berkeley, but I actually did. And I went to college outside of Boston, a small women's college, and then went back to Berkeley for law school. I spent the first part of my legal career working for a law firm in San Francisco, and I did mostly intellectual property litigation for technology companies in that practice. And then I think when I was about 7 years, after practicing for about 7 years, one of the partners I worked with was asked to go back to the antitrust division and work there on a big merger at the time. It was two big telecom companies. And when he left, I said, well, you know, if you ever need help, I might be interested in coming back to help. And about a year later, he called me and said, you're still interested. So I moved from San Francisco to Washington and started working at a Justice Department. And I ended up being...
Have you done antitrust before, or did you, was it your first move into it?
It was more or less my first move. I mean, most of the big cases that we handled on the intellectual property side, we did a lot of work for Nintendo, and there was clearly a time where, believe it or not, Nintendo actually was alleged to have a lot of market power in the video game industry. And so there were, whenever we filed intellectual property cases, we typically would have antitrust claims brought back against the company. And that was how I first became involved in doing antitrust work. But I had never done it in the way that I do it now or in the way that I did it at the antitrust division before I took a job at the Justice Department, moved to Washington.
My brother also is in antitrust, but it seems like he's been doing antitrust for a long time. He studied that and has gone all the way through. You found it a little bit later.
Yeah, and Matthew's sort of a true blue antitrust. I'm what some people consider to be an interloper, but it's certainly become my career. And interestingly enough, you know, I didn't take it in law school. I didn't study it. And I was talking to someone else who was actually one of the lawyers who represented Netscape at the beginning of the Netscape Microsoft stuff. It turned out that neither she nor the partner that she was working with at the time had taken antitrust in law school either, and both she at least had started out as an intellectual property litigator too. So I think people who are looking for interesting practices that have sort of real world aspects to them gravitate towards it as a subject matter.
So, I mean, my list and my audience are CEOs of companies doing between about $1 million a year up to about $1 billion. Why is antitrust relevant to them?
Well, it's relevant on a whole variety of different levels. If they ever are involved in a transaction, meaning buying or selling.
And you know what, before we go down that road, maybe we should actually clarify exactly what antitrust is. What is antitrust?
So, antitrust is an area of law which is designed to preserve the competitiveness of markets. And the goal there, is not to keep people from getting big or to punish companies for getting too large. The goal is to keep the marketplace from suffering from impairment to its ability to function properly. And so what that means is that people are what it's trying to do is to make it possible for people who have interesting ideas or new products or innovative ways of doing business, it makes it possible for them to succeed in the marketplace despite the fact that they're small. And it makes it possible for them to be assured that if one of the large competitors tries to do something bad to keep them from succeeding, the law will be there to protect them. But it really is just about keeping the free market working fundamentally, which is kind of a broad, big way of describing it, but that is the goal.
Because it seems to me like when I hear about interest, which I hear about it a fair amount in the news, in the Wall Street Journal and online, it comes up in the context of Google versus Yahoo and all that sort of stuff, which is just $1 billion companies fighting out and then getting regulated by the U.S. government. How does that then become relevant to a $15 million a year startup?
Well, I mean, it can touch a company like that in a variety of different ways. And what I was trying to say is that one of the easiest and most common ways is just a basic kind of rudimentary thing that happens, and that is that if you're being acquired by someone or you are acquiring someone, and you are a certain size or the entity that you're doing business with is a certain size, then you have to file a report of a form with a bunch of information with the Justice Department and the Federal Trade Commission, and they get the chance to review your transaction before you can close. And so Very often, small companies are subject to these reporting requirements because they're being acquired by much larger companies. And it's also the case that, so that's just a kind of a basic way you run into it, at least in the U.S. And most foreign jurisdictions have reporting requirements like that as well. So the other way it's relevant is that it just is you can, and this is our practice involves a lot of small technology companies. They're not necessarily at risk, but that are occasionally being pushed around by larger companies that have already gotten into the market and have what we call market power in the world of antitrust. And the antitrust law can be used by those companies either by getting the government to start investigations, which is one path that people go down sometimes, or even by suing in private litigation. There were, you know, Microsoft again is a classic example.
So you were explaining how antitrust can relate to smaller businesses that are growing.
Right. So as I mentioned, one way is just that you kind of run into the antitrust laws in the context of any kind of, not any kind of, but some transactions that you might be doing. And there are lots of different ways that those reporting requirements can affect small companies. They even affect people when officers, when they're buying too much enough stock of the companies they're part of. So that's one easy way. It's not the most interesting way. The other way is that it can be used as a tool to, for lack of a better word, go to war with a larger competitor that's threatening you in some way.
So this is, antitrust then becomes a way that you're dealing with a very powerful company, for example, Microsoft, or that's now becoming Google, where my brother's at, or any of these others that are big companies that have a huge amount of market power now. Antitrust can be a way for a small company to take on a big company.
Right, and there are lots of examples of that. You know, Intel and AMD are going at it. AMD is fighting against Intel, both by suing down a lawsuit, but also by getting the European Commission and trying to get the U.S. and any number of other foreign entities to start investigating Intel's business practices. And I can just hang up a large competitor for a long time with a regulator, you know, poking around in their documents, which could be just as a matter of everyday business. Not only hassle for them, but can have pretty severe consequences. And Microsoft is sort of a classic example of that. They've been under regulatory scrutiny for now more than 10 years as a result of the kind of thing.
Obviously, there's been a whole Netscape and Microsoft thing. And Netscape looked on, and obviously Netscape now gone away and was acquired by AOL, and the browser's been discontinued. You could hardly call that an antitrust victory for Netscape. So, I mean, was that considered a success, and aware of cases where a startup has used antitrust successfully against a bigger competitor?
So I think there are different ways of thinking about it. I think it was a success in the sense that it sent a signal to Microsoft that it couldn't engage in these kind of business practices and not get caught and taken to task for it. And Microsoft has clearly there's been a drag on Microsoft for a long time as a result of that case. Now, Netscape itself obviously is, was kept from being, or at least was kept from the potential that it had to be, a big player in the browser market. I think that the way to think about the case is from the larger impact it had on the technology marketplace, in the sense that it told large companies in the tech sector that they weren't immune from this kind of regulation, that the Justice Department was capable of mustering the resources together and combating them, and that they needed to be careful about how they behaved. And I think there were real technically arrogance, there was some arrogance in Microsoft, but I think there was a real sense among the Silicon Valley, at least in the U.S., that said, hey, you know, they're never going to come after us because we're this new dynamic market and nobody could ever ever understand it well enough or do anything in these kinds of markets to affect us. And I think the case really said, you know, it's not true. The other thing in a more practical sense is that, you know, all these Netscape, Real Networks, which is another company that was alleged to have been harmed by Microsoft's conduct. Now, all of these companies in the wake of that lawsuit have settled cases with Microsoft, and I can't now remember how much money Microsoft has made out, but it's been in the more than a billion, I think, in settlement of cases.
But, I mean, well, Real Networks are still going okay, but I mean, Novell and most of the others have kind of got trashed. But I guess, could this raise a question there? I mean, Visa hadn't done real well. Microsoft's on a downward slide, and they hope to get it right with Windows 7. Could the antitrust settlements against Microsoft be one of the things that's kind of held the company back and caused Apple to start moving forward and open up more opportunity for others? I mean, the browser's not doing that well either. I mean, all this stuff, it's affected, they're being affected on every front. Is antitrust one of the reasons?
Yeah, I think the answer to that is sort of. I mean, people comment now that, you know, Microsoft used to be an agile, you know, competitive entity, and that they are now kind of like a slow, lumbering beast. And a little bit like what happened to IBM in the wake of all the
antitrust. It's exactly how it feels, actually. It's a big beast, and I got a really big bank account. But the stuff that I'm seeing from them now, they just don't quite get it.
Right.
Do you think is it antitrust, or is it because Bill Gates has stepped down, and you know maybe Steve Ballmer's not up to it as much as Gates is? Is it something like that, or is the antitrust regulations and the things that happened to the company as a result, is that what's causing it?
I think a combination of all of those things, but I think essentially once a company becomes subject to the kind of scrutiny that Microsoft had been, and you know I worked on the case when I was at the Justice Department, the people were just involved in not every aspect of the development of their products, but they had regulators or people working for the regulators watching everything they were doing, and I think that really does slow you down, and it's also, I mean, there's a way in which companies just mature over time, and I think they get large and a little bit more, things are harder to turn on the dime when you get to be that big. But I do think that going through that process and recognizing that you couldn't just kind of freewheel your way around the marketplace did have an impact on the company.
So what kind of, today, like what kind of antitrust things is Microsoft having to do to comply with whatever they have to comply to?
The main things that they're currently having to do is license some of their technology so that, and this is both in the U.S. and in Europe, they were required to license what are called communications protocols. It's the way the server talks to the Windows operating system. So they're having to license that technology, in some cases for free. They're having to license it to the open source community in Europe, at least. And that I think, a big deal for them because the primary competitor on the server side has been Linux servers. And Microsoft is... These settlements, I think, will help those entities do better in the marketplace as a consequence.
Specifically are they being forced to license? It's not Farmer for the disk integration, is it? Because I think that's reverse engineered. So what kind of stuff is being licensed?
It's the instructions and language. It's the technology that the server uses to ask the client operating system to send it information. So it's what you have. Sorry?
It's the file sharing stuff, is it?
Yep. And Zomba is part of one of the entities that I think, at least in Europe, people hope will benefit from having this technology. The claim, and this was a bigger part of the European case than it was in the U.S., but the claim was that people like Sun and Zomba and Red Hat, who build competitive servers to Windows servers, couldn't make it in the marketplace because the Windows servers just always did a better job communicating with the Windows client, and the Windows client was a monopoly on. And so if you couldn't sell to a company a server that communicated seamlessly with all the computers that they were working with in their business, then what good was it? And so the goal of this part of the remedy was to even that out and make it possible for those entities to compete so that Microsoft wouldn't then not only have a monopoly on the desktop, but would also have a monopoly on the server side.
And so when Microsoft has these restrictions in the U.S. and Europe, do they then roll that out worldwide, or are they going to do whatever they want in the rest of the world?
It sort of depends. So they have been under scrutiny in Korea, and the Koreans had a case against them, also not on this particular issue, but on another issue which related to bundling of instant messaging programs. But they, as a general matter, I would say that they do these things worldwide because the technology markets tend to be global. But they do, the license in Europe that they're required to enter into is slightly different from the license in the U.S. That there are differences across the jurisdictions. But as a general matter, once you start getting involved with a company that size that does business around the world, that any activity or anything that you make them do, meaning you being the Justice Department or other regulator, is going to have a worldwide impact.
So let's say I'm doing some stuff that's pretty innovative, and I'm having some problems with the market power that Yahoo has. And let's say it's in the advertising arena, because a lot of my guys are doing internet advertising, internet marketing, that sort of stuff. What could be an example of a case around advertising where Yahoo could be an antitrust problem for us? And as a startup doing $50 million a year in revenue, what can we do about it?
So I think the kind of cases that are most likely to be successful in this kind of area that we're talking about now are cases where somebody, whoever it is, whether it's Yahoo or somebody else, is taking actions that make it difficult or impossible for you to distribute your product effectively to the people who you need to get it to. So, and that's in the lingo of antitrust called distribution foreclosure.
If I have something that I want to sell, and assuming it's legal in all jurisdictions that Yahoo's advertising in, the price I can pay for the media is competitive. If Yahoo's refusing to run my advertising, then that's an antitrust issue. Is that correct?
It would be if Yahoo had a product that competed with you. So say you, both you and Yahoo are selling, I don't know, Christmas trees. I was looking at a web tree.
So I'm doing great with Christmas trees. I'm doing $50 million a year in Christmas trees, and I happen to be very lucky because it's selling all year round.
Exactly.
And then Yahoo decides to go into the same market and sell Christmas trees as well.
Right.
What you're saying is that Yahoo can't stop me from advertising on Yahoo's distribution platform for selling Christmas trees.
That would be a potential antitrust problem. Yeah.
So, I mean, that is fascinating. I didn't realize that sort of thing existed. So, if that actually happens, I can then go and, you know, start muddling about antitrust to Yahoo, and that will generally force them to open up their platform and allow me to run the advertising does.
It might. It sort of depends. Sometimes people are, it depends on how good your case is, and it depends on, how much they're willing to fight. But it's certainly, when we're advising small companies that are having problems like that, you know, where larger competitors, for example, try to shut down trade shows. That's a classic example. Somehow they made it impossible for your internet email program to work for their users. So if you logged on somehow through the internet portal and you were a Yahoo user, if you couldn't send messages to people on Hotmail or something like that.
Actually, I just read something today that Hotmail is apparently not working for people who are using Linux. There's something that's just recently changed.
Really?
That's the kind of thing, is
it? Yeah, that's the kind of that would be an example of something that if the Linux people might want to get somebody to figure out what's going on, why is it happening, and is there a problem there? These are all ways in which you can use, a smaller company can use antitrust as a tool, and often, you know, just the prospect, and we used to do a lot of work with, in my old section of the antitrust division, we did a lot of work with the financial markets also, and, you know, typically people just don't like to have other people, and particularly regulators, looking at all their documents, because by and large, you're going to find something eventually, exactly. So I always felt like the big financial companies always did everything possible to avoid getting into any kind of issue with us because they never wanted to hand over any documents because it can lead to trouble. So so I think it can be a very powerful tool, and if you're doing it in a multi-jurisdictional way, so if you get the U.S. interested, you get Europe interested, you get Korea interested, you get Japan interested, these are entities, now China and India or have large, you know, big monopoly laws, if you can get a lot of different jurisdictions moving, and it's relatively, as compared to filing your own lawsuit against another company, it's relatively inexpensive to do that.
How much is relatively inexpensive?
Depending on how good your case is, you could probably get an investigation started, you know, somewhere for work that in the range of, you know, I would say something like $20,000 to $50,000.
For this scale of stuff, it's effectively free.
As opposed to the millions and millions and millions of dollars it would cost you to prosecute a lawsuit against somebody.
So you're out with a huge amount of leverage because you can spend $20,000 to $50,000, go get all these investigations started, and then the government takes over and pays for it.
Yeah, I mean, most of the government agencies expect a complainant, like if you're the one who's unhappy about the stuff, to support their investigation and to be available to them to help them. Because the interesting thing about working in the government is that you realize you don't have client to teach you about the industry or to tell you how things work or to do any of that stuff. And as a consequence, they really do need the help of people who are in the industry. And if you're a person or entity that got that things moving, they generally will expect you to invest some resources in helping them pursue it. But the cost of getting the thing up and running, assuming you're successful at doing that, is as you said, comparatively, you know, it's almost zero.
Let's say I'm running my company and I'm based somewhere in the U.S. But you know, I don't know anyone in the Department of Justice. I mean, you know, I do what I got to do and I run my business. But how on earth does a little guy like me get the attention of federal regulators to put them on Yahoo?
You hire a lawyer, I'm afraid to say. So you hire somebody who knows how to put together the information in a way that's going to be persuasive to them, and that will go into the agency and explain to them why it is that they should look at this and why the conduct that you're concerned about isn't just bad for you, but it's bad for consumers. And that's the other touchstone of all of this, is that antitrust is not about hurting competitors, it's about hurting consumers. So whenever anybody, you know, is thinking about going into a regulator or suing under the antitrust laws, you really have to think about telling a story about how the harm that's happened to your business is impairing you and keeping you from bringing better, deeper products to consumers. Because that's what they care about, and that's what the law cares about. We always joke around that, you know, the investigations where when we were at the Justice Department, that, you know, if a competitor was really, really worried about a particular merger or other transaction, we usually thought, okay, well, that means that this is actually going to be good for competition because your competitor is concerned.
There's a lot of people online. I have some interest in as well in the views of libertarians. And libertarians would say that antitrust, I imagine, tell me if I'm wrong, that antitrust is just a sign of big government going in to regulate things they shouldn't be regulating, and that it should be a free market and let the market work itself out anyway, without any kind of intervention. What's your response to that?
So I think, you know, that there's a balance there, and that is certainly what the libertarian view of antitrust is that it's not, it itself interferes with the free market. My general response to that is that the market's not perfect, and it doesn't work perfectly, and that when you have companies that have what we call durable and is long-standing market power, meaning that it's not just a flash in the pan, it's going to last for more than a couple of years, their economic incentives turn in such a way that they actually are working at cross purposes with the way that the free market should function, because they get the most benefit out of keeping that market power in existence, regardless of whether or not the next little guy who's come up has a better idea and a better, cheaper product. They don't care. They want to keep making the money that they're making. And as a consequence, they start thinking about the world in a way of, how do I preserve what I've got? And
so rather than thinking about how can I innovate after the next thing and kill your own product because you're innovating out with the next thing, instead of how can I lock the market down stronger so that the new innovative thing can't get past that
thing? Right. And how do I keep what I have instead of how do I move forward and continue to do new interesting things so that I'm responsive to the marketplace out there? So I think, you know, there's obviously a balance there, because interfering with the marketplace too much, I think, can mess things up. There's no question about it. But doing nothing, there's a lot of discussion right now about the economic crisis in the U.S. and whether or not the lack of regulation from the financial markets was a cause of it. And, you know, I think it'll take us, you know, a long, long time to know the answer to that question. But there's certainly been a lot of discussion about whether or not the SEC and the Commodities Futures Trading Commission and other places, other, you know, government regulators should have been more involved in regulating the investment banks. And, you know, shockingly, you see some of these companies like Morgan Stanley and now saying, I want to become a commercial bank and subject myself to greater regulation.
Right.
In that process.
But then they get access to the withdrawal, government access to cash and stuff.
Right, right.
it's a fascinating environment.
Yeah.
So you're saying that there's basically a balance. So the libertarians are saying antitrust is bad. You're saying we need some of it, not too much. Does that sound
right? I think that's right. I mean, I think too much of it can, you know, clog up the marketplace in a way that is just a drag on a free market. I think that's absolutely right. But
I've read a bunch about the history of John D. Rockefeller and Sand Oil, and learned that antitrust is actually against the trust. And the trusts were what they made in the 1880s and 1890s. You'd have a trust that made your oil, and another trust that made your sugar, and another trust that made your butter, and the whole, everything's run by trust.
Mm-hmm.
I don't actually completely understand what that means. Is it just a collection of companies collaborating, or was it always just one single company that had market power? Like, how did the world actually look in those days that caused antitrust regulation to come out?
I think it was not a collaboration among, and I, to be perfectly honest, my history knowledge on this is probably pretty lame, but the problem was that these large companies simply had too much power and force in the marketplace, and that they were impairing the ability of the economy to function in a way that I think people realized it really needed to function in order to, you know, transform itself in the 20th century. There is a part of antitrust that is about illegal collaborations between competitors, and we haven't talked about that at all. And my recollection of this is that that's not particularly what was going on at that time. But it's illegal for companies to get together and agree on the prices that they should sell their products at, or which part of the country they're going to sell in, or which kind of customers they're going to sell to. And it's illegal regardless of your size and regardless of how much power you have. You simply cannot do that.
But let's say if it was a bunch of $5 million companies all ganging up against one other company, is that something that antitrust would still step in for?
If they were getting together and agreeing to, for example, boycott a particular distributor, a large distributor, it could be. There are lots of cases, and the classic example of the kind of thing you're talking about are cases where doctors get together and agree on how they're going to negotiate with insurance companies or hospitals, and those are violations of the antitrust law. That they can't be.
What if a bunch of $5 million companies get together against a smaller competitor and have an agreement on how to handle that competitor?
Same thing.
And in a case like that, is that still the same sort of stuff you pay? You get your attorney and file stuff with the government, and they go and look into it all?
Yep. Yeah, I mean, you can also just sue them directly, but yes.
How routine is that sort of thing? Does that sort of thing happen a lot?
I mean, there are tons of these. These are typically criminal cases where if you're getting together, well, it depends on what you're doing. But if you're getting together and saying we don't want to deal with that distributor, that's going to be a civil case. If you're getting together, no matter how small you are, I mean, you can look on the Justice Department website. There are all sorts of rinky-dink people getting together and, you know, fixing prices on I don't know, a recent case, and these weren't rinky-dink people, but, you know, marine hose for I think oil rigs. if you are and the technology market, you know, the biggest ones recently that the Justice Department did were these cases involving price fixing and DRAM. And you know, people went to jail and paid lots and lots and lots and lots of money in fines in those cases. And
they went to jail for antitrust issues. So this is where they got together in a room and set prices on stuff.
Absolutely. And in DRAM cases,
that's
actually...
That's something you go to jail for.
Yep. Yeah, and in the DRAM cases...
Why would that be criminal rather than civil?
The notion behind this is that kind of behavior is so pernicious and so against the principles of the functioning of the free market that the liability should be criminal. And this is sort of an interesting area because there's not a bright line between when you charge someone with criminal violation and a civil violation. But people say that if you're literally getting in together in a room with your competitor and the classic smoke-filled room scenario, you know you're doing something bad. You are cognizant that what you're doing is not consistent with your obligations as a good actor in the economy, and we're going to prosecute that criminally. And executives go to jail for that, say, pay millions and millions and millions of dollars in fines and hundreds of millions of dollars in fines for that kind of behavior. And just to note, the interesting thing about the DRAM case was that it was not a situation where people got together in a room and talked. It was a communication, a much more... obscure way of communicating the price issues. People having lunch, people talking on the phone, that kind of stuff. It was not the classic smoke-filled room.
What are the typical types of illegal collaborations between competitors? So there's pricing, there's selecting, working with another related company. What would be some others?
Yeah, so the two big classic examples are price fixing. Price fixing, bid rigging, and market allocations. And the two first two are probably pretty obvious. The third is where you agree with one of your competitors to only concentrate in a particular type of product, because you say, I'm going to take toilet paper, you take paper towels, or you take DRAM, I'll take SRAM, or I'm going to focus my business on selling only to customers in California, you take Nevada and Wyoming, or I'm going to focus on just selling to customers that have businesses with more than 500 people in it. If you're, you know, an ERP software seller, for example, you say, okay, you take all the big companies, I'm going to take all the small ones. What you're doing when you do that is you deprive those customers or those markets, those geographic areas, of the competition between the two entities. And you're essentially agreeing upon, between the two entities or the three entities or however many there are, an agreement that you're going to be able to have a lock on this particular area or this particular type of customer. As a consequence, you're going to be able to charge them whatever you want to charge them because we're not going to compete with you there. So those are the three: bid rigging, price fixing, and market allocation are classic criminal violations.
So here in the Dominican Republic, which is where I live, it's an island. It's a country of about 9 million people. It's obviously third world. There's a couple of very big companies that run a lot of stuff. One of the biggest, it looks like their annual sales is somewhere around $500 million a year, and they control the sales of some of the major brands of alcohol and cigars and things like that. I would imagine that this country doesn't have the resources or the side to justify any trust, or maybe they're incorrect. I'm wondering, some of these companies have been around for 100 plus years. Is this the sort of stuff that, because there isn't probably isn't any trust law here, that's the reason why they are to have such market power and bank power?
The other possibility is that there's they've been government owned, and that there's a transition from a government controlled economy to a private economy, and that's what happened.
Some of them came about when there was a dictatorship here in the past.
Right, so there probably was.
During a dictator's time, right. But they are privately family held. I think they were created during the smoke-filled backroom room.
Right.
Now, like 40 years later, still incredibly powerful.
Right.
And no one can be able to compete.
Right. It's possible. Often, one of the things that happens in the U.S. that drives people crazy is that sometimes different state legislatures are passed laws that immunize. Alcohol distribution is one of the classic examples where the states will enact what are essentially very protectionist laws for the local distributors or local producers. So that sometimes protects entities like that. I think lack of antitrust regulation certainly can have an impact on that. But it's interesting, I was in Japan last year at a meeting of the International Competition Network, and there were antitrust regulators from all sorts of little teeny countries. It's a growing field of interest for even very small economies. But obviously, you can have an antitrust law, but whether or not you have the resources to invest in the wherewithal to go after a large company if they're violating the law is a different question.
So from the other side, Are there lessons that startups can take from companies that have successfully put themselves into a position where they do get prosecuted by antitrust? Are there things that we can look at and say, you know, these are the kinds of things that we can learn to make ourselves more competitive? Is there anything that you think a company could apply?
Apply from the antitrust context.
Yeah, because you know, antitrust, your area is all about making sure the companies stay competitive. So you're looking at how companies get to some size in their restraining markets and stopping people from becoming competitive. So there's obviously some techniques that big companies use that stop the restrain competition, make themselves stronger. Mm-hmm. Are there things that we could be thinking about now, like, you know, there's the playbook, the 10 antitrust, or the 10 tricks that Microsoft used to become in the position it's in? Are there things that we can learn from that to apply to our business models?
Well, so you don't want to do those things as a general matter. Some of them you can do. So, I mean, there's lots of things that people do to protect and to protect their marketplaces. So, for example, exclusive relationships with suppliers, and those can be legal if you're small enough and you're not foreclosing a rival. So, I think there are the principal tools that Microsoft used to hurt Netscape were using the primarily its relationships with its OEMs and with its other software developers to impair Netscape's ability to get out there on desktops and be used by consumers. So on a smaller level, you can do some of those same very same things. And these were mostly what you want to call exclusive dealing relationships. and that is, you know, just saying, I'm going to enter into a deal with, and I'm going to say something, and I haven't thought through whether or not this would be legal or really illegal, but you say, I've made this beautiful new kind of pottery, which is, will last forever, and you can use it to make dishes, and it never breaks, you can drop it on the floor, it feels like glass, but it's not glass, whatever it is, and I'm going to make sure that I'm the only person who can distribute those through UPS and Federal Express. I'm not sure that would help you, but you can.
Okay.
But you can think of ways.
That's kind of why you do it. If they commit to signing that, then you deal with that.
Right.
Are there any others that are possible that are legal, obviously?
Yeah, I'm just trying to think of other things you can do. I mean, the main kinds of things that, again, that you're going to be looking at is how do you sort of keep yourself out in front and legally keep your rivals from getting to be in the forefront of people's minds. So. And the ones that are coming to mind are different kinds of exclusive relationships with suppliers or distributors or advertising channels. You know, we talked about the example of selling Christmas trees on using internet advertising. And you know, done correctly and by a small enough company, those kinds of relationships I think can help you succeed and are can be legal. So. Sorry, I'm not going to have a better example.
I bet you haven't asked that question many times before.
No, most of the time, what people want to know is, what can't I do?
Right.
And typically, typically when we do counsel, people come to us and say, hey, I really would like to do this. Is that okay? And sometimes we get pretty interesting questions that way. But usually business people are the ones who are thinking of the clever ways of making sure that their product succeeds and not the lawyers.
Right. There's been obviously antitrust issues between Google and Yahoo. Are you able to comment on any of those?
I'm not really. I'm afraid, since I did a lot of work for Google on it.
Okay. Then I've asked you everything I can think of. Is there anything you'd like to talk about that we haven't covered?
I don't think so. I mean, I think I'll just give a plug for antitrust as an area that's both interesting and again relevant to your the kinds of people who you are working with on your website. It is one of the most interesting and fun things for antitrust lawyers to do is to have someone come to them and say, I've got this big company and they're giving me a really hard time. Help me think through all the various ways that I might be able to fight back. And there are a lot of different options.
Your life, huh?
Yeah. Hmm. And that's
cool.
The fun thing to do.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. I really appreciate your time.
Great.